Very last conference or session of the whole interactive thing. Thank you. It's awesome to see people here at all. There's our third panelist too. I'm Matthew Bellows. We have two distinguished mobile and video game execs with us here from Austin. And just to let everybody know, if you can, turn off your cell phone ringers. There's a card going around. There should be evaluation cards going around, so please fill those out. Please give us very high scores so we can come back next year. I'm going to let Mark and Paul introduce themselves and kind of tell you kind of where they're at in terms of mobile. The panel is called Mobile Games and the Future of Video Games, or something to that effect. And the basic idea here is that, you know, we're going to talk about what mobile and mobile entertainment means for the interactive experience, you know, this year, next year, and into the future. So let me ask Paul to introduce himself first.
Hi, my name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I've started in the interactive entertainment industry, or what we call the video game industry, in the early 80s. I was about 12 years old, working for a company called Sierra Online. Some of you old schoolers may know that company. Worked for them junior high school, college, and then after I got my international business degree, went to work for them full time. After that, I spent a couple of years at Activision. I opened up Gremlin Interactive's North American office, brought all of our games from Europe here. We were acquired by Infogrames. Gremlin Interactive, sorry, Grand Theft Auto was our famous franchise. We're acquired by Infogrames, worked for them for a while, and then moved to Austin to start my own consulting company, which is where I met Matthew. And Matthew's actually the inspiration when he said, why are you representing developers and licensing their products to publishers when you can publish products yourself to the carriers? And then he made some really key introductions for me, and I started a company called Pulse Interactive in June of 2003, publishing games to various carriers. And I started in the U.S. with Verizon Wireless, and then slowly branched out to Singular, Altel, and the other big carriers in the U.S., and then South America, and then Asia. And then sold the mobile game business to SkyZone Entertainment, which is an SK Telecom company, in August. And so now I'm consulting for them as part of that asset sale. And then on the side, I'm doing some Xbox Live Arcade games, and I'm consulting for another mobile company. So that's my history in 30 seconds. And I'm very opinionated.
Hi, I'm Mark Pierce, and we have a company here in Austin called Super Happy Fun Fun, and we do mobile games. We've been doing mobile games for about almost 4 years, going on 4 years now. We started off developing as a developer, and now we're beginning to publish with Verizon, U.S. Cellular, and other direct relationships we have going on. I started in video games in the early 80s also. I wasn't 12, but I was like 18 or 19 maybe. My first game for Bally Midway, an arcade title, and then did a bunch of ports for ColecoVision and other platforms out there at the time. And then started a company called MacroMind, which later on became MacroMedia, and we designed a product called VideoWorks, which became Director. And then went on and worked for Silicon Graphics and did a game called Dark Castle for the Macintosh, and then joined Atari Games, the real one, not the French one, in Milpitas, California in the late 80s, and did 6 arcade titles there as lead designer, team leader, etc. And in 92 took over product development at Atari Games, making coin-op games, and some of the games we delivered were Area 51, San Francisco Rush, and a number of other titles that did fairly well and closed that out, and then came here 2001 and started Super Happy. And so,
what's the name of the company again?
Mine? Super Happy Fun Fun.
Okay, thanks. So it's awesome to see a lot of people I don't know in the audience, because we tend to go to these mobile game shows and it's all like people that we already know, and so it's really cool to see people that we don't know out there. Can I just get a sense of, like, how many people out there are sort of familiar with mobile games as a, like, you play them? And familiar with the industry, like, you kind of know what the basic dynamics are? Not really.
Double.
And sort of, a couple people. And sort of you're interested in sort of figuring out, like, how you do it, or what's interesting about it, or why did you come here today? How you do it? How would you develop a game for cell phones? Okay. So I'm going to introduce myself by way of brief introduction to the industry. And the basic idea here is that I just wanted to show everybody kind of like, here are some innovative, creative things that are happening in mobile right now. We want to make this interactive. Everyone's tired and ready to go to the bar. If you want to step up to the microphone and ask a question at any time, please do so. If you got your DS, I'm in chat room A, and you can just PictoChat a message. I've got my little friends here from Imoco who are like taking notes on the whole thing. I work at a company called Floodgate Entertainment. Floodgate Entertainment. We're doing some corporate branding work now, so I'd be interested in your feedback on any of these logos. We make cell phone games mostly. We make games like Madden, NASCAR, Age of Empires for the PDA. We did a big game with Disney last year for a big movie that they had that I can't mention, but it made $1 billion in a couple months. You've heard of it. We've also done some PC games like these sort of core gamer RPG, kind of action RPG games, as well as a casual PC title that we're working on for the summer release. Why are we doing mobile when we did a lot of PC? Because a lot of the guys in my studio came out of PC game development for years and years and years. Shorter development time, so as opposed to a 2, 3, 4 year product cycle, it's a 4, 6, 9 month product cycle, which is just a lot easier, more fun to work on. Smaller teams, so not teams of 30, teams of 3, to get a good game out if you have good quality people. And obviously, you know, from a macro view, much larger market, 180 million console, game consoles of some kind out there. Cell phones is approaching 2 billion, you know, cell phones in the world worldwide. So, you know, at that level, even though you can't actually sell to all those phones, you kind of think, wow, this is a much bigger market to kind of invest in.
Well, that's actually a big part of why I entered mobile, right? Because when you make an Xbox game, the maximum amount of sales you can make for an Xbox title is what's penetrating to the market. So let's say there's 5 million Xbox 360s, the maximum number amount of Xbox games you can sell are 5 million, plus a fat royalty to Microsoft on every single disc. So how many cell phone games can I make? Over a billion. If you penetrated North America, South America, Europe, and Asia, well over a billion, actually. So the potential to really make a killing is there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, totally.
Okay. Did you not understand anything?
something about a billion.
Yeah.
So the market penetration of mobile phones.
Oh, I got that far, you know, just in general.
Okay. But you understood last part of what I said?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, good.
Moving on. There are some real issues with mobile game development and the market in general right now, including the primacy of brands, the terrible shopping experience on the phone itself, and the way that basically that drives consumers to go with what they know. So the biggest selling cell phone games in the world are basically brands that you've all heard of, like Tetris or Snake's not even sold, it's just given away, right? But games
Excuse me,
let me just finish.
Didn't I have
point.
Snake?
He sold Snake.
I sold Snake.
Oh, the first game was Snake.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He copied it and sold it.
Yeah, you copied it and sold it. Yeah, that's totally possible, and that's cool. But also things that are like not even brands, but just things that people know how to do. So bowling, Texas Hold'em poker. Those are things that are instantly recognizable. Choices, the consumer is awash with choice. Even though the carriers are cutting back on the number of phones or games that they show on their deck, there's still, you know, hundreds that are available through Verizon right now. The distribution channel for actually developing and then publishing and then putting on a retail shelf, i.e. the carrier handset, is completely messed up. And being a developer in this space, I mean, except in this panel, but usually when I'm on these panels, I'm like, I'm the weakest person here. I'm the least powerful person here because basically, you know, in general, we're not... We can't really do much. And here's the worst part of all. This is a picture of kind of how we think about porting a game. So on an Xbox or a DS, you make one game and it runs across all 3 or 6 or 10 million consoles out there. For us, we make a reference build and then we make 6 other reference builds and then we port that out to different families of reference builds. So like a 2D build on a low end and a 2D build on a high end and a 3D build on a low end and a 3D build on a high end. And then there's localization issues and it becomes quickly, you know, 4, 5, 1,000 SKUs, you know, individual executables that we either as developers have to build or get ported and then distributed.
So it takes about 100 million builds to sell to 1 billion phones.
Right, exactly. The dirty truth comes out. So that's a cry for help if anyone's got a good solution for that. But despite that, people are making some pretty cool efforts to make this into a viable creative medium. And despite the fact that Tetris, you know, sells a huge percentage of all the games that are bought in North America, there are companies who are trying to do cool creative stuff with this medium. That's kind of what we wanted to talk about a little bit. So just let me blaze through these slides as fast as I can and give you some examples. NOM. The phone, the controls on this thing are awful for playing games, and so there's a genre that's evolved. It's the one-button game, and you just need one button to play it. And NOM was one of the first fun examples of that. You got a guy running, and he runs around the window of your phone, and you just press when he has to jump over an obstacle. And the trick with NOM is you have to keep rotating the phone as he moves around the screen. His head is always in the middle, you know. That was a success. They did a sequel, obviously, and the sort of payoff moment from the sequel is when you finish the game, they would transmit a special SMS to a satellite disk in the Ukraine, which would then blast your SMS message out into outer space. Skipping Stones was by the same company. They took that kind of one-button mechanic, made it more friendly, made it more consumer-oriented, made it more casual, and they sold, you know, several million units of Skipping Stone, which is also a fun game. From the one-button game to the many-button games, we did this game called Mopets, which Sony BMG is publishing. And it's got a lot of mini-games in it as you raise your pet and teach it new tricks and stuff like that. But one thing we did is when it's feeling sad, you know, you want to pet it. So you actually pet the keys of the phone in different combinations, and you figure out, like, what's the magic spot to get him to be happy. So that's the all-button game. Princess Maker is the Tamagotchi-style nurturing kind of raising games is a popular genre in cell phone games, and Princess Maker was one of the early ones in Japan where you basically adopted a little girl and then raised her up to be a princess. And there's nothing untoward about that. Go Supermodel is sort of like the U.S. version of that where you raise a supermodel and watch her diet and, you know, dress her and things like that. Bizarre. Mini Lovey is kind of the same idea, a Tamagotchi-style thing, except they use the network in a really interesting way so that you, when you get to a certain point in the game, you can send a little egg of your Mini Lovey to a friend, and that egg shows up as a link that they can then download the game to their phone and start off kind of where you were at, and sort of a viral distribution through using SMS as a medium to spread it peer-to-peer. Excuse me. Ferrari Racing from Infusio use that same kind of SMS trigger within a game, but to buy power-ups. So you can text at some point from the pit to basically buy better tires, buy a better engine, using SMS as the payment mechanism. Blades and Magic, I mean, this is like obviously the core gamer kind of men in tights kind of, you know, swords and sorcery kind of genre. And interestingly enough, there are actually people out there that are increasingly core gamers that are playing cell phone games. You know, even 2 years ago, this was not the case. But these kind of games are being targeted to them.
And I think in Korea, these are huge. Korea and Asia, these type of games have really taken root, and there's huge followings for them. It hasn't happened here yet. It seems like an obvious thing. You know, all these are connected devices. So right away, everybody, when they first come to the phone business, start going, well, let's do a network game. Unfortunately, in America, that has not taken root yet. There are a few exceptions, but it's definitely a niche market. But in Korea, this type of game is, from as I understand, is, you know, the main staple of what they live on.
Yeah. Sims 2 was basically the first big large-scale mobile game that had a big web presence and then connected to the console, so you could actually play your Sim on your PC and then upload characteristics of it to a website that was part of the game experience. You could post your game pictures on your website, and then you could actually take some of that stuff into the mobile version and back and forth and back and forth. So it was kind of a good example of like a big behemoth publisher not generally known for innovation kind of stretching the boundaries of the medium, and I think this is one direction of where you'll see us going as an industry. Jumango Island is sort of even crazier than that. They have a web client, which you see in the middle, a Java client, and then a WAP client, and it's a MMO, social networking kind of place with not a lot of gameplay value, but a big community, and they were actually claiming a million registered users last August. So they've got the strip bar there, so it kind of attracts people. Russia. Here's snakes.
3D snakes.
Yeah, not your snakes, yeah, but another snakes that you ripped off.
Thank you.
Snakes, obviously the first mobile phone game ever, and this is a 3D version that Nokia did for the relaunch of, or for the launch of their N-Gage phone. Nice. The cool thing here in terms of, you know, creativity really is that you could download it from the web for free, you could pass it peer-to-peer from device to device for free, and it had a pretty cool Bluetooth mode that you could play. You know, the whole idea of like making this into a console like you see in the console world is just not that great an experience because basically the phone is so underpowered compared to the consoles. But Need for Speed Underground was one game that really tried to do that, and it tried to do that basically by caching megabytes of data, songs, tracks, new car models, new textures, stuff to buy, all on the network, and then streaming it down to your phone as you progress through the game.
Which works on really nice high-end phones.
And that's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But phones are getting better, so I didn't mean that necessarily negatively, but
on the
it's
other
not the norm.
Yeah. Right. On the other end of the spectrum, Sill is a game by Telco Games, which has won a couple awards in the last couple months, and it's basically a 3D puzzle game where you just rotate an object that's given to you in space and try to match up the object with the silhouette. It's definitely a fun game to check out, and it looks gorgeous. 3D Tilt-A-World by Mark's company is another way of getting outside the limitations of the control scheme here. It basically uses the camera on the phone as a control mechanism, and you basically hold the phone and then tilt it this way, and the camera senses your movement and then relays that motion into the ball.
Much like the six-axis controller, except you're actually using the camera instead of a gyroscope.
Yes. But let me say something else. There's new things that are coming up. We're very proud of Tilt and very happy. It's got a lot of press. We won some awards and stuff. Sales have been good on it. I think, though, it reminded me as a game maker, I've done games for over 25 years now, that innovation is really important, and the amount of energy and buzz you get from something that's truly innovative is, it reminds you why you did this stuff. And it's real nice to see, too, we came up with this camera thing by partnering with a company called Gesture Tech that had the technology. And now phones are all going to start having triaxial accelerometers in them, which is a fun word to say. But it lets you, move the phone around now and uses control things. So I think this is something else to think about. And the thing I'm most proud about Tilt about is that it really is made for mobile phones. It's not, like the Need for Speed game, which is a glorious looking game and everything. I don't think really maps to a phone that well. The controls are terrible, and it's just not a great experience. So, I think people, if you're thinking mobile, I believe that's the way to go if you can. It's hard, we do driving games too, but from time to time to try to reach out there and do something innovative is key.
But see, that's the whole point of original IP. If you take a look at 3D Tilt-A-World, it has no brand, but it doesn't matter what platform you create a game for. It doesn't matter how snazzy the graphics are or how great the 7.1 surround sound is. If you have a game that has great gameplay and it's fun to play, that's what's going to sell. And that game is really, really fun, and it has no brand. Another great game that had no brand was a game called Grand Theft Auto. And after coming out with 5 iterations of it, it now has a brand. Same thing with a game called Tetris in 1986. Had no brand, right? Nobody knows what the hell is the word Tetris. It doesn't even mean anything. But you play the game, you get addicted. All it is a bunch of blocks.
But you're doing console games on mobile too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So some licenses are great and they translate well. And people that flip through the deck is the menu of games on your mobile phone. Some people look for brands like the Need for Speed brand. They know what that is. Oh my God, I want to play that game. So you might get a sale out of that. But if the game doesn't lend itself well to that platform, let's say you make a horrible NFL game. Obviously, everybody knows the NFL brand, but if you make a horrible NFL game, it's not going to have very much legs. But if you license a brand and then you create a great game around that brand that's fun to play and has great controls, and people want to spread it via word of mouth, then obviously it's going to have legs. So there's a fine line there between licensing and original IP, and I'm very, very much an original IP person unless I can find a brand that I can move over to the mobile platform and do great things with. That's where you're going, right?
One of the original camera games that came out in Japan is this game called NEC Photo Battler, which was developed for NEC phones to promote the use of the camera on early Docomo phones that didn't have cameras before this. This is a game where basically you take a picture of an object in real world, and the game algorithms translate that picture into some kind of characteristic, almost like an RPG, you know? And then you go head-to-head versus whatever other things you take a picture of. So you can take a picture of your friend and, you know, see what the game... It's kind of random. You can see in one of these slides, the woman in the center slide has just beaten a box of Kleenex in the game, but you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's just sort of like it's a fun kind of mechanism, and this kind of thing has been you know, experimented with a lot recently. This is a game not so much about playing in a virtual world, but helping you play better in your real world. So it's a dance game like DDR, except it actually uses the camera to map where your feet are, and if you're moving your feet along with what the dance step should be, it gives you rewards, it gives you points. And if you miss up, then it's, you know, sort of almost a tutorial, almost a game kind of thing, but the real world. And of course, if you can't dance and get insulted, you can take a picture of the person and play devil darts on your phone with the camera. Let's Go by Train is another of these games that merges real world with virtual world on a cell phone. This game, again, a Japanese title, basically was mapped one-to-one, moment-to-moment with the Tokyo subway system. So if you got on a certain stop and started playing the game, driving from that stop to the next stop, the time that the train would take and the time that it would take in-game would match up exactly. So not necessarily a thrilling game experience, but actually sold a lot of units because there's a whole audience for simulations out there, right?
This was originally a coin-op game called Densha de Go, and that's what all that scribbly stuff means by Go. And Japanese, I guess, because I'll make some gross generalizations here, spend a lot of time on a train. There seems to be a very big population of train enthusiasts, and this game basically simulated you being a train conductor, which you can imagine, you know, there's a switch
and,
like
and
this.
And it was a PS2 game, wasn't it? It came with a big controller.
Yeah, and it has like, a big, you know, it's like model railroading almost over there. It's just huge, so very interesting to hear that it came to mobile. I didn't know that.
And the natural extension of that is Let's Get Our Driver's License, which is more recent and takes you through, you know, parallel parking and three-point turns on a cell phone. You do not actually get your driver's license from this game, unfortunately. And the ultimate of real-world video game kind of crossovers is Pac-Manhattan, which a company called Area Code built a couple years ago. And it's played on the grid of Manhattan City streets. As the and some people play as Pac-Man, some people play as the different ghosts, and there are various places that are designated as power-ups where the Pac-Man will turn around and chase after the ghosts. And it's coordinated by sort of teams, one team playing Pac-Man, other teams playing ghosts, and they go out and play each other. And they've actually sort of created an open framework for running these games such that you can download the kit from the Area Code website and play. Is there an Area Code guy here? Yeah, it's just great stuff. I mean,
was he dressed as Pac-Man or a ghost?
I know, right? another sort of vector here is Flash, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about Flash-like games. Super, super simple kind of, this is a, you know, Worms game, Tanks game, whatever, but looks a lot prettier in Flash, and there's a couple examples of these things where you launch your match off into space and you get points for splashing into the biggest pools of gasoline and the biggest explosions that you have. Time Noodle is a noodle sim that's done in Flash, which to me looks more like, you know, Grand Theft Auto Japan. But, you know, sort of, we'll talk about Flash a little bit, I think, when we get into it. And then because it's like a small medium and because it's like kind of flexible and new, there are crazy developers who just go outside the rules completely and make games like Shit Panic, where the poop drops off the bum at the top and you need to move the toilet across the bottom. Spermageddon is another example. It's a, you know, swim to the top of the screen, avoid the IUDs and the, you know, try to find the egg. Fartbox is a ringtone maker but with farts, and it has a built-in whoopee cushion timer. And Flitzer was a game that came out for the World Cup in Germany where instead of playing as one of the soccer players, you play as a streaker. And you do different special moves, and you get points, basically, from the crowd for avoiding the cops for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, the company that we licensed some of our games from made that game and was wondering why we couldn't bring it here.
Yeah,
I was like, well, besides soccer not being very big here, I don't know if the carriers would like a naked man running around the screen.
This game launched in Germany, yeah.
Yeah.
There's some differences, and we'll go into that after Matthew's thing, too, about the markets out there in terms of what they accept and the carrier control here in the U.S.
I think that's the end of my thing. Oh, no. I just wanted to make a point that we're at the very earliest stages of this whole thing, right? This is Buster Keaton film level, right? We're just starting to get sound to work on a lot of these Java phones. We're just starting to get the network to work at an entertainment level, you know, where it's not just a tech demo. And, you know, so from a creative standpoint, this is like the early, early days of actually figuring out stuff that could actually work. And then once we actually get that to work, that kind of entertainment experience to be portable across the 1 or 2 or 3 billion handsets that will be, you know, available to do this kind of entertainment, then there's devices that people are making for dogs, you know. So what's the first dog cell phone game that'll be out there? Like, there isn't one, but Bilingual kind of points the way that, hey, there's no reason why just people should have cell phones, you know? How do you play with your pet? Thank you.
Yeah, so to speak to Matthew's point, we were just talking about this before this panel. This industry is literally only 4 or 5 years old. It's very,
maybe 10 years old, but that's how you count. But
yeah, well, for, you know, rich media stuff like what we're doing now, downloadable content. So the creative aspect really is there to sell 5, 10, 100 million copies of a mobile application. Some of the intellectual property that I kept that I did not sell in August, we're allowing people to buy lotto tickets on their cell phones. This is a big secret about 2 years ago because I didn't want my competition knowing about it, but we're so far down the path that it, you know, I've been telling everybody over the last year. So think about that. Think about Mega Millions right now that has, I think the jackpot is something like $400 million. And instead of running to a 7-Eleven, you know, you can just hit the button and do a quick pick and bill a dollar to your cell phone. Like, you're already paying $35. What's an extra dollar in case you win $350 million? Let's say, you know, there's a site called Hot or Not, or
I think it's a stat actually about the odds of winning the mass megabucks.
Yeah.
1 in 172,432 or something like that.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I'll take that. It's a buck.
Yeah.
It's a buck. And besides that, when you play one of our scratch off games on your mobile phone, you're not just taking a quarter and scratching off that silver. You're actually playing a rich media experience. So in my opinion, it's a little bit more fun. The other thing to note that is the lotto demographic right now is 55 and older. And our demographic for mobile lotto is 18 to 45. So we think we're onto something there. And then, you know, this whole location-based thing, which we haven't talked about yet either. I mean, in case you don't know it, most of these new phones, I'd say like 95% of the new phones are coming with a GPS chip in it. So what can you do with that? Verizon Wireless has this thing called VZW Navigator. So it's basically a TomTom or a Garmin GPS device on your phone. So you enter the address and it gives you left and right directions. I think it's amazingly, ridiculously expensive, but it's there in case you need it. And that's
10 bucks a month, right?
Yeah, 10 bucks a month. Yeah, that's not so bad. Or it's like $4 a day in case you just need it for one day, right? But you can do amazing things with that. I mean, we're using it for lotto to make sure that they're in the state, right? You can, so if you're in New York, you can buy a New York lottery ticket. If you're in Florida, you can buy a Florida lottery ticket. But for dating, it opens up all types of things. Let's say I want to meet a girl between the ages of 35 and 45 within a 5-mile radius. And then it pulls up all the profiles and pictures. And you can, you know, and you
who
don't...
Who has a cell phone that runs on Verizon. And
absolutely. You set up a profile.
Pulls up a map to their house.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's what the carriers are afraid of.
Exposes a social security number.
So,
do you have a question back there?
Yeah. Can I ask one question?
No, sure. Just one.
So it seems as if a lot of these games are available in the U.S., so they all...
Some of them are, yeah.
Because it seems like a lot of them are using a combination of digital compass technology or maybe accelerometer stuff that's not available in the U.S.
Yeah, actually, the myth of the U.S. being behind in the mobile entertainment world is just that. It's a myth. I mean, a lot of the kind of most crazy whacked out stuff is happening in Japan, but or Korea. But for the most part, the phones, the networks, and especially the lack of fragmentation in the market in the U.S. is really very attractive for a number of different reasons. So you don't need to go to lots and lots of different little carriers like you do in Europe to get your game out there. So there's a lot of emphasis being placed on developing quality mobile content for the U.S. So it's not like I was at a panel earlier today, and the guy was like, "Oh, Europe is so far ahead of us and stuff like that," but it's actually far from true.
There are some things, though. Distribution and deployment is probably the biggest challenge. I think you see a lot of these games here, and they all look very interesting and wonderful. And you know, we've had some success with Tilt, but we're only on like two carriers right now, and we're working to get onto more carriers. It just takes time and energy to deploy across all of these, unless you partner up with an established company already. But if you partner up with them, then there's other downsides to that. What's happened in Europe, and what I think Europe is ahead of us in, is the ability to send out applications to the devices directly. Wow. And the way most games, as I understand it, are consumed in Europe, I think it's about 80% are from websites, off-deck sales, and about 20% are on-deck, whereas in America, it's about 74% on-deck sales, meaning through the carrier's billing system, and about 25% or whatever through off-deck.
Right. To demonstrate that example, you can go to handygames.com and download Flitzer for your mobile phone by giving them a credit card number, and they'll bill it to your credit card number, and then you download it to your phone. So nobody knows about that in the U.S. because it takes literally millions and millions and millions of dollars to broadcast that message.
Yeah.
So the only way us Americans are downloading games are on our phone, which is unfortunate for developers and publishers because they'll make more money if we start selling it from our own websites.
Yeah, the other thing, too, that's a challenge here in America is, for example, with Verizon, which has about 40% of the game download sales here in America, I think, maybe 50%, you cannot send an application to a Verizon phone unless it's been digitally signed by them. So in other words, you have to go through their system, which has a lot of advantages, don't get me wrong there, especially if you're from Verizon here today. Anyway. But you can still go to Singular. T-Mobile's clamping down the door. You can't send an attachment with them. We have a distribution system, and we're sending out games and applications and ringtones to places in America, but they want you always to go through their system. So once you get of a substantial size and volume, then they're going to want to get in, and then you're going to have to get set up with premium SMS and other things.
Because they want a piece of the action, basically.
Yeah. Whereas in Europe, that's still kind of open. So I think it leaves a lot of freer opportunities for distributing stuff. But all of it, it's very difficult to monetize, to make your money back on these games, unless you do have that distribution portion down, either through yourself or with a partner.
I mean, Electronic Arts couldn't figure it out for a couple of years. I remember speaking to them in June of 2003 at a conference in San Diego, and I was talking to our director of business development at Electronic Arts, and he said, you know, I want to get into this whole mobile game thing, but I can't find out the economics. I don't know how to make the economics work. He said, so you make one game, and you port it to hundreds of devices in the U.S., and then you have to go out and sell it to each individual carrier, and you have to do the same thing in Europe, and then the same thing in Asia, and the same thing in South America. I said, right, welcome to the world of mobile games. And so what did they do? They wound up buying one of the largest mobile game publishers who had actually figured it out. They bought Jamdat.
Yeah. So the question...
Jamdat.
Jamdat, yeah.
The question is sort of like, are we having fun yet? You know, like, you know, Mark, you want to...
I'm having a blast. I sold.
Yeah, I did a thing at the Game Developers Conference last week, and the title of my lecture was, Are We Having Fun Yet? And what I was asking myself as a developer and also for the consumers, as a developer, I would say having fun means that I can create innovative titles that have an effect on pop culture, and that I have the budget to innovate, and that I can also make money. And so that's what you're doing development for, I think. There's other reasons too, but that's major ones. On the consumer side, it's that I can find activities I want to do, become addicted to them, and not care about what they cost. And so that's kind of, you know, the other part of fun. And in mobile, I think we still have, we're starting to have more fun now, but we still have about a year or so more to go. It's one of the slower moving, fast moving technologies I've ever seen. And it has so many different factors, and it's such a fragmented market with how many devices you port to, all the carriers, and all the other little things you have to know. It's still a very challenging space, and it's still, even though there is opportunity to hit billions of handsets, and certainly Tetris has done that, few titles have. And, you know, a million seller is a really great thing to have still. 100,000 is probably more typical, I think, for most games in terms of units. You know, they kind of start petering out, I think, at that level. Obviously, if you have huge brands like pirate games or things like that, you know, you will get bigger penetration just because it's riding that whole marketing bandwagon. But it's still a very challenging format. What is changing is the capability of the devices is getting better and better, and so that makes it nicer. What is changing is that I think we're going to stop screwing the customers so much. What I mean by that is right now when you release a game, you have to cover low-end handsets. And I don't care what game it is, but for most part, most games are not fun on low-end handsets, but you have to release on low-end handsets. You sell everybody on the picture from the high-end handsets. If people buy it on their low-end handsets, they have a bad experience. It's the first mobile game they buy. I don't like this. I'm not going to do it again. So we got to go through a cycle of earning those customers back, and that's a big thing we'll have to have too before we can have real fun.
And talking to that point, we made a mandate at Pulse Interactive to give a demo, whether it be a 5 or a 10 minute demo, of each one of our games away for free. And if you can't do that and have a satisfied customer, you have no business selling that game. I'm sorry, that's the bottom line. If you don't feel comfortable with selling a demo, and we all know that people go through the deck and look for free demos and never buy any games. I'm fully well aware of that, right? Because I do the same thing myself. However, if you do have a great game and you believe in your game, there's no reason why you can't give away a free demo and feel very good about selling, you know, a couple hundred thousand copies.
Go ahead.
Another point that I want to expand upon what Mark said, handsets are, in fact, getting very, very powerful. This handset has a couple hundred megahertz processor. It has 512... 256 meg of RAM, and then you also have a mini SD card, and it also has a 3D accelerator in it as well. So in March of 2005, Qualcomm struck a deal with ATI to embed ATI's mobile 3D accelerator chip inside every single handset that they send out. Now, whether or not the mobile handset manufacturer actually utilizes the 3D chip is up to them. But chances are, if you bought a phone that's manufactured after March of 2005 in the U.S., it has a 3D chip on it. And then later I'll give you a demo of Quake 1 running on this handset.
The mobile games industry right now is kind of at the low point of the hype cycle, right? So a couple years ago, there was tons of VC money flowing into the space, tons of people saying we're going to build big, you know, big publishing companies based on mobile, and in the last year, it's really been like, if you're an established player, you might make it. Don't enter right now. You know, sharks are in the water, basically looking for consolidation. In fact, when I joined my mobile games developer, I had a friend who's a publisher of a big company come up and say, "When the consolidation comes, call me." You know, and that's kind of that. That's kind of the feel of it out there right now, which I think is actually a good time to start experimenting a little bit because the tool sets have been developed to the point of view where you don't need to roll everything yourself. And it's kind of an open field again. I don't know if you feel the same way. Would you recommend people get into mobile now, you guys?
I think it's extremely difficult.
I wouldn't do another mobile game company right now. No. After the pain, I mean, dealing with the carriers, these people don't play games. That's the bottom line. So when you go to submit, if I offend anybody on the carrier side, sorry.
You're not going back anyway, so.
They don't play games. So when you submit a game to Verizon or Singular is actually different. Andrew actually used to work at Sega. But Verizon was pretty tough for a while because none of those people play. As a matter of fact, when we used to send in our games, they wouldn't play it. They would look at the screenshots and they would look at the descriptions of how I would describe the game on their little submission page and vote it up or down. And I'm like, no, you have to play the game. It's the experience. You know, we're going to give away a free demo, and we know we're going to get hundreds of thousands of people downloading that free demo. You should play it. And then, you know, after a lot of lobbying and actually flying up to Maryland, we're finally able to get these people to start playing games. But they're not from our space, so it's very, very difficult to get a game passed.
Can you go to the mic so they're recording it?
Hi. Which leads to a question. Like, I live up in Alexandria, Virginia. They're going to put like a Wi-Fi citywide network up there and all that. And of course, there's a little WiMAX. Is that going to be usable as a network for this purpose? And wouldn't that actually have faster bandwidth than like cellular or something like that? Or so, where's that all at?
There's a lot of you know, mobile is what it is today, and you can answer to go into this further, but I think there's so many disruptive opportunities at all levels. And I think WiMAX, you know, we're all sitting here worried about the carriers and all that. I mean, WiMAX is totally disruptive to the carriers. And it's not going to happen all at once, but I mean, things like that could very well change. I mean, where if you have an IP-enabled device that can communicate, then you don't need a carrier. You don't need Verizon anymore. So that's kind of interesting on a lot of levels.
Which is why Sprint is spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to build out a WiMAX network so that they can own
their own WiMAX network.
But it's a good point, and it sort of goes back to what Mark and Paul were saying before. Like, all the vectors of this as an entertainment device are improving, from the processor power, the embedded memory, the ability to add new stuff, the networks that you're just referencing. Like, so there's something happening, you know, but the cards haven't shaken out in the right way. Sir?
I'm curious about your opinions on something like the OpenMocha open source phone, and if something like that could bring more openness to the gaming and give you guys a little more ability to create these games and skirt the carriers on those things, and we'll give some more innovation.
You still need distribution, right? So depending upon how it's distributed, I mean, let's say you have a Wi-Fi phone, you can get games via Wi-Fi, but I mean, you're talking about an open source OS?
The entire phone.
Yeah.
So you still need to get distribution.
How do you monetize it? That's the question.
How do you sell it?
So I guess they'd have to enter in their credit card number on the phone to buy it, or?
What I'm wondering is, you know, it's a phone where you can just put your SIM card in it, and I'm not familiar with mobile building.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have things like Verizon locking only sign
right.
executables going into it, and it is run apart from the carriers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think all those efforts to open the ecosystem up are awesome, basically, and people are trying, and I think the carriers are responding to that in some ways by trying to be more open themselves, and you know, to the extent that they can, based on their kind of legacy business, they're trying to adapt. But the more different ways that people are trying to break this up and kind of try different things, the better. And all you have to do is compare the development of mobile games and mobile content in general with the development of web content in general over the last 5 years. And it's just crazy to see, you know, how much more faster, better, cheaper is happening on the web. And so, like, that kind of approach, it's not going to make a huge, you know, revenue difference to a big mobile games publisher. But, you know, there could be a core following that gets, you know, 200,000-400,000 phones like that out there, and suddenly you got a small niche audience that likes this kind of stuff, and maybe address that specifically.
Yeah, a lot of this reminds me of the early scenario for DOS gaming, where you had three different memory models, you had five different graphics models, you had et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and for better or for worse, until Microsoft and Apple come in and blow away Amiga and Atari ST and everything else and say, okay, you got to conform to DirectX or OpenGL, suddenly gaming becomes far more feasible. Who do you see as the big dog in this industry that's going to come in and say, you will conform? I mean, I'll refer to your diagram before about the reference build and the 400 different reference builds you've got to make around it. Somebody's got to consolidate this before it's really feasible, and it's also true of the providers too.
That would actually make our life a lot easier, to be honest.
Well, it's not only easier. You're not going to monetize this thing until that happens, because I think you're too fragmented.
I think one step that I just found out about recently, it's been announced for about a month or so now, is Nokia has I guess reintroduced their N-Gage platform, and if I understand it correctly, they're going to, if you comply to this platform on all future Nokia phones going forward, your games will play on this platform. And they're striking deals with the carriers directly. And so if you buy a Nokia phone, you will have on the deck of these phones a Nokia channel, which you can purchase games from. And Nokia is a major carrier, and I think this is very much alike what you're talking about with Apple, or, you know, how Sony came along or Nintendo came along. They define an OS and a platform, and then they support that platform, and then they also handle the billing and that. I'm very hopeful for things like that.
I am too. The problem is there's not very many Nokia phones in the U.S. That's the problem I see with it. Going back to what you said about...
That's a problem and an opportunity. I mean, for me, I mean, it's easier for me to get onto U.S. phones, and getting to Europe is more difficult for a small publisher like myself. So this is a really nice answer to have.
For Europe, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. OpenGL ES is now the mobile version of OpenGL. So if you write an OpenGL ES game, will it run on all OpenGL ES phones? No, unfortunately it doesn't. Unlike the PC, if you wrote an OpenGL game, will it run on all OpenGL cards? Pretty much yes, 95%. But we're finding out with Quake Mobile, since Quake Mobile runs OpenGL ES, we have to fine-tune it for each and every phone. So it's a big porting job in and of itself, even though it's running a quote-unquote standard.
Yeah, roughly half of a big game development budget goes to solving this issue. So there are companies that are addressing it from a technical standpoint, you know, sort of outsourced porting companies that do craftsman-like work on each individual handset for relatively cheap because they aggregate builds across and build technologies. There's also sort of companies where you can send them your code and they'll return back, you know, 550 Java builds for each handset at a kind of flat rate level. So people are attacking it that way. But in terms of like a Microsoft coming in and being like, this is how it's going to be because of a power of a monopoly, it's very unlikely. And in general, the idea of a unified platform standard for mobile games is just not conceivable.
I can't hear you.
The question was, how do you become profitable if 50% of your budget is doing porting?
Well, Qualcomm tried to do it, right? They have this platform called Brew. And their big mantra at the time was, write your games for our platform, and you put it up on our server, and the carriers pick from whatever games are on that server. And it was a great idea, and everybody bought into it. And then we found out what really was the case. You still had to sell all the carriers. You still had to do all the porting, and it became a mess. But, oh, by the way, Qualcomm still gets their 20%.
It's the power of the size of the market, actually, that makes this even conceivable to think about. Because and frankly, there's some amount of defensible sort of approach. Once you build frameworks that support porting or at least make it easier, you actually have some amount of barrier to entry against other people. So, question.
Just one quick comment. That 3D Tilt-A-World game was truly revolutionary. Like, that was really nice.
Thank you.
Like, to me, that's up there with the Wii in terms of taking on
a new
tech type of technology and really specific. But my question is about what you were just talking about.
Do you want to bask in the glow of that for a second?
I am. Thank you very much.
Yeah. glow, yes.
Then let me just say real quick, that's the... One of the main things that keeps me going, and we talked about this too before the conference, is that to date there really hasn't been a mobile title that's gone elsewhere. It's all Tetris coming here and Pac-Man, all great games, you know, coming here. And the opportunity as a craftsperson to be the guy that comes out, I'm not saying Tilt is that thing, but to be experimenting in its space and having a shot at coming up with the mobile application that then goes elsewhere is pretty exciting.
Yeah. So. Well, and I mean, not to belabor this, but that type of game is what makes me want to be involved in this mm-hmm. industry, right? It makes me want to get my company involved in this industry. But my question actually is just I wanted a clarification on a point you'd made earlier about the outside porting companies. And I just wondered if you had any recommendations, because that strikes me as an area that you could end up getting burned pretty badly. So I just wondered if you had recommendations on the types of things to check out with those kinds of companies.
Do you use a porting company, or you do everything yourself?
We have never used a porting company. We've been a porting company, and we end up porting a lot of our titles. And our publishers have taken our titles and used other porting companies. But I've never directly do that. However, that's changing right now as we speak. And as the industry is consolidating, what we're finding out too is we go out and look for porting into other territories, we're turning around and getting work from those porting companies to port into our territory. So,
right.
You know, I can talk with you afterwards.
Yeah, there's come up afterwards. Yeah,
there's a number of companies. You do have to be careful because there are a bunch of companies popping up all the time in India, Romania, and China.
Yeah.
And they could be good and they could not be good. You go with somebody who's been around for a long time, and, you know, that generally helps. And, you know, there's a period that happened in mobile, too, that I'm glad to see kind of ebbing away now, and that was, you know, everybody got on the mobile, everybody's on, got on the bus, okay, let's go, and I said, okay, and then they found, oh, you're in America, I'm going to go and have it done in China, and then they all went to China, and they found out it ended up costing about as much when you start figuring in the communication, the time zone differences and everything, and so now those people are coming back here and realizing that, you know, there are times to outsource and there aren't times to outsource. And
yeah,
so,
totally. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
I also have a great porting recommendation for you.
Cool. So just to wrap up, we got a couple minutes.
Big stick.
Predictions, gentlemen. Predictions for mobile games and the future of video games.
I think we're just at the very, very beginning of the hockey stick curve. So I think the more carriers realize that games will be driving more revenue in the future, and the more innovative, original ideas that we can bring to this platform, sans licenses, the more units we're going to start to see selling on the mobile platform.
Yeah, I think it is still an industry that it's very difficult to. I think all games business is very difficult to make a living in, and like, you know, the NBA or famous rock bands, you know, you know about the 1 or 2% that get all the airplay. It's very, very difficult, and I think mobile is even that much more difficult for a lot of reasons. But I also think the promise for me is there to stay and persist in it. The opportunities there, and just the excitement. You work on the devices, and every month, I mean, the stuff that comes out on these phones is just incredible. You know, he quoted some numbers there. I know the new Qualcomm chip supports up to an 8-megapixel camera. I mean, it just keeps going faster and faster, and the numbers are huge, and it is the largest installed base in the history of computing. And so that's exciting to get to that. And, you know, we do stuff besides games as well. We do mobile search, and we do other applications for other people. And it's just an exciting space because you're in somebody's pocket. And, you know, then you get into their head through their pocket. It's kind of interesting. So
I predict that by this time next year, you will see the first mobile game go to another console.
Okay. March 13th.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.